as I get closer to where he went off the road, I see a big black shape in the middle of the road walking. So I have to slam on my brakes and try to swerve myself because this thing is walking in the center of the road. Because I don't see a head and I don't see arms. I just see a really big, tall person, like big, thick legs and a big, thick torso. And they're moving very funny.
But to be honest, I wish I had have seen some of her vulnerability. I wish I'd have seen her in that space so that I would have language.
And he says, no. That's not why you're angry. That's why you're mad. Mad is on the surface. Mad is a surface emotion. You're angry. And anger is deep. That cuts to your soul. You are an angry young man. And I couldn't answer. I then had come to realize over the next course of a few hours, I'm musing to myself, and I realize I've been a victim my whole life. That's why I'm so angry. And over the course of the next 19 months, this man changed my life. He helped me to realize about processing emotion and how to forgive myself and forgive others. And that's where the metamorphosis really began for me. And I learned how to, I'm a survivor, right? I know how to survive.
I was understood for the first time in my entire life. And when I read those things and I learned, quote unquote, those things about myself that I had known forever, but never really had the semantics for, I couldn't unlearn them. Like I heard this quote years ago and it resonated with me so much. And it's like, you can choose to look the other way, but you can never again say you didn't know.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Verbal Echo Podcast. I have Ben Stempson here with me today. He's an integrative therapist, spiritual director, award-winning author, podcaster, and independent scholar of folklore and history. He's a member of the modern neo-pagan and queer communities. His personal life helps to inform his professional and research work. Ben holds a BA in medieval, classical, and religious studies from the University of Waterloo, a postgraduate diploma in spiritual psychotherapy, and a diploma in social service work. As a therapist, he excels in working with members of the queer community and other marginalized populations and ascribes to transpersonal, systemic, and narrative approaches to therapy. He's the host of Essence Podcast, a weekly show interviewing fellow authors and practitioners in the field of alternative spirituality and therapy. His debut title, Ancestral Whispers, A Guide to Developing Ancestral Veneration Practices, was released by Llewellyn Worldwide and won the 2024 gold medal at the Culver Awards. Welcome, Ben.
Hello. Thank you.
You have such a diverse background. And I was reading through your pie. I will copy and paste this in the show notes because it's pretty impressive. And that was just a little snippet of the bio and all of the work that you've done. You're also the host of Essence Podcast. Is this a new venture that you started?
I actually started it in 2020, but because I go season by season, I really ramped it up early last year as a way of connecting with other authors in my niche and putting my name out there. It's on hiatus right now because I'm writing another book, but it will come back again at some point.
Oh, wonderful. That's so exciting. And let's just dive right into your books, first of all. And if you want to throw in some of this amazing history, but it looks like you have a new book coming out. Mm-hmm. And I'll let you introduce that and then maybe just talk about the book that you already published.
Of course.
I'm really excited to hear about this. And I'm sure that this is going to spurn quite a few questions that I might have. So absolutely. Let's jump into it.
You know, you said, I have quite a diverse kind of life, and I do. I have a very diverse lifestyle. They interconnect to all of my pieces of my life interconnect. And so the first book that I came out with, and we'll talk more about that, is Ancestral Whispers, and it's a guide to ancestral veneration practice as a form of spirituality. And then connected to that, because it's also part of a witchy kind of neo-pagan metaphysical community that I'm in, I just completed a large source book called Wise Ones, Legends of Witches, Cunning Folk and Magicians of England and Wales. And it's a compendium of 220 individuals, and the stories connected to them. So these are everything from, like, you know, the hag in the dark woods, to the little old woman at the end of the village who, you know, supposedly practices witchcraft, to the wise man who is going to help you find a cow by doing astrology and things like that. So really a cool tradition from the past 300, 400 years. And I'm currently working on a sequel to that, which is focused on Scotland and Ireland. So I'm really deep in the trenches of folklore right now. And it does intersect with that my ancestral work, because these are stories that have been handed down in the culture from my ancestors. So it's all connected.
Thank you. That's really interesting. I guess my first question is about the ancestral work and the history and the diverse background of UK history. And I absolutely love UK history. I'm such a history buff anyway. I always watch all the shows, all the history shows on
everything on
UK history. Yeah, my own genealogy is from Europe, so I'm always interested in learning about history and the travel of peoples, and then folklore totally fascinates me. So, how did you come up? I guess what was your passion like? How did you get started with that?
And how did I fall into
history?
It all? Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of a wild journey. So my interest in folklore really is connected to my actual trauma as a kid. So when I emigrated to Canada as an 8-year-old, I was bullied because suddenly I was different. I had a different accent. It was around 1995, and around that time Harry Potter came out. So of course in 1999, I was a little kid, British kid, glasses, you know, dark hair, and a little scar on my forehead. So what go figure? What do you think I was called, right? So it was funny. And a lot of the media that I was consuming back then was all, you know, King Arthur and Robin Hood, and that's part of the culture over there. Like, you can't go anywhere without local legends. The area that I was living in the UK was North Wales, a very rugged landscape, has a similar feel to, like, Appalachia, for example, right? Just anywhere that has that feeling of mountains and little glens, and there were fairy tales all over the place in that. So I survived through that culture shock by really diving into folklore and stories. And that actually led me then to neo-paganism and modern magic and that whole sphere. And that became an important part of my life, really jump-started my spirituality. And almost coming up to 10 years ago now, I became part of a working group. And it was a working group. It was neo-pagan, but it was really connected in with Jungian psychology, and working with the archetypes, and working with story. So Joseph Campbell's monomyth, right? The hero with a thousand faces. And it was really cool to immerse myself into that. And from that, I gained my interest in psychotherapy and in counseling, retrained as a counselor, and kind of went off in that direction. And then from that, I was also working in ancestral work. So ancestor work as a form of spirituality, different from grief work, different from mourning, and looking at how to build relationship with the dead now, right? How to build actual relationship instead of mourning their loss, connecting with them now, communicating with them now in a way that is very meta, you know, through mediumship, through psychic skills and whatnot. And through that regular practice of having them in my home with an altar and a shrine and working with them in that way. And through that, I reconnected with history, because I've always loved British history. I've always, like, it's the history of our people, right? So because my background is kind of mixed, I have people in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, England, Cornwall, all over the place. It was my way of connecting with them through that history and connecting with myself. So out of that, I developed a little program and a course, I should say, around family trauma and working with like kind of family history trauma, right, through my psychotherapy stuff. And then from that, I developed this book. So I was like, oh, let's. And that's how I spent the pandemic. I literally, one of the lockdowns up here, I sat down and started writing a book, and I was like, you know what, I'll do this. Why not?
I think
And
we
here
all
we are.
dove down some rabbit holes during
All
the
over
pandemic. Oh my gosh.
the
Oh boy. And I think it was really beneficial for a lot of us too, because we might have all had little projects on the side that we wanted to explore. And then we're like, okay, now what do I do? And we're all stuck at home. I think the first thing I did was I took a photography class through Nikon. Nikon was offering all these free photography classes, and I spent like 16 hours over 4 days learning like all the ins and outs of photography. And I thought, oh, this is so cool. I mean, it was fun, right? And then I thought, and then I had more time to think about it. And then I went down the spirituality route myself, and I started taking mediumship classes
Fabulous.
through the College of Psychic Studies in the UK.
Wonderful.
So I have lots of friends over in the UK now.
I know some of the teachers who teach there, and they're fabulous. Nicholas Pearson. I'm going to give a shout out to Nicholas
Oh,
Pearson. You know Nicholas, yeah.
I know he's on my Instagram feed. I've taken a little Reiki thing with him.
Oh, perfect. Good, good.
Well, and then Jim Harold interviewed him. I first learned about Nicholas from Jim Harold's Paranormal Podcast, and
Yes.
he this is a few years, obviously it was a few years ago. But I was so taken with his knowledge, and I thought, oh, Nicholas is great. And so
I'll
yeah.
have to. I'll have to get you onto his show. He's looking, so I'll have to get him
Oh,
onto your show.
really?
Yeah,
Oh,
I will. I will connect
gosh.
you too.
Oh, he's just such a lovely person. And I follow him. I think he's based out of Florida or something now,
Yeah, he's in
but he
Norland now.
teaches. Yeah, he teaches. He's just a lovely person. He's just
He is. He's one. This is the coolest thing about becoming an author in these fields is connecting with people who I may not have known them before, but I knew of their work or I've been reading their stuff for years. And then I actually get a chance to like connect with them as colleague and connect with them as friends. And it's been an incredible thing. It really does show that community aspect that I love, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny that you're mentioning that aspect of community, because I just reconnected with someone from CPS that I took classes with, and he just started a Facebook group, and he's invited, I think there's maybe 25, 30 of us now on his Facebook group, and we were chatting back and forth about, oh, I want to take another course at the college, and so I signed up for another course this
Why
fall.
not, right? Why not?
And I'm trying to get him on my podcast too, but he's retired. He's a busy guy, so he's got many things. But yeah, I think that's the thing is, when you do the things that you really, really love and bring and give you passion, then you build your own community. And I do, it seems like everyone that I have that lately that I have on my podcast, we've been discussing that. The weird synchronicity about building community
Yes.
and how it's so important, and it stems from doing the things that you love
Very much so. Very much.
100%. Even if you go out on a limb and maybe your uncle doesn't know what that is, or your crazy aunt, but it's okay because you have this community and they're supporting you and whatever creative or artistic or educational or project that you want to do. It's such a cool thing to have that community. So
And it's the awareness of that synchronicity. And I mean, it's a good segue back into what we were talking about. I actually had an experience where all of these guys came back into my life 1 year. And every single one of them was somebody I had known about 10 years or 5 years previously. Didn't have any intention of seeing them again, but they all had some sort of unfinished business with me, whether it was I just couldn't get over them or they couldn't get over me or something, right? And that year I had seven of them come back into my life. And at the end, my really, really good best friend from a few years before, who we had a big falling out, and I didn't ever intend to see him again, came back into my life in a very weird synchronicity way. And at the end, I was working with a priest of a tradition I was working with. And he said, that's your ancestors trying to get you back to where you're supposed to be, right? That's when it was like, okay, the spirits in my life, the ancestors in my life, the deity or deities in my life, the universe, whatever, was really pushing me towards that place of health again. And after that, everything fell back into place again. I went back to school, trained as a psychotherapist. From that, I was able to go back to school again, finish my BA. I wrote a book because of the opportunities from all of those connections. Like, it's just my life has changed in the past 10 years from what it was. And it was because I became aware of that synchronicity, became aware of my place in community again. And throughout my book, I talk a lot about responsibility, responsibility to, responsibility of. And I think that that key word there really comes in with that community idea,
That's so important. Yeah, definitely. The synchronicities are, I'm astounded constantly. I think I'm just more aware of synchronicities now that I kind of know how they work in the universe.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating when I have another synchronicity, and it's almost like it's just an affirming of, oh yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, I'm on the right path, doing something the right way. Yeah. And when I don't have those synchronicities, that's when I know I'm a little off track and I need to realign with my soul's purpose. And I'm sure that that's kind of how it's supposed to work.
What was the weirdest one for you? Maybe I'll be the
synchronicities.
Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, I've had so many. Okay, I'm going to throw this in here. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with this author, Mike Cleland, Owls and Synchronicities.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm working with that synchronicity right now. I did finish his book, and he's got another one, which is really fascinating. It's a collection of accounts of people who just have written, I think he started it on a blog or something. That's how he collected the stories of people experiencing owls and synchronicity and encounters. And so he compiled them all together. So his second book, I haven't listened to yet, but it ties in with some synchronicities that I have, and I'm still trying to figure them out, but I've had so many owl synchronicities.
Interesting.
So I'm definitely drawn to him, and I would love to have him on. I hear that he does almost any interview. So
just reach out, honestly. I mean, I'm sure anybody listening to this is like just reach out, just do it. Right? Yeah.
I know, right? And there's a synchronicity right there. So I have a question. All right. So when we're talking about this term, and I've heard this term before, cunning folk.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about the practices that magical people, I'm not really sure. Maybe explain this to me. What exactly did they mean when they said cunning folk?
Of course, definitely. So this is why I wrote the book. This is why I really wanted to get these stories out there, because this is a portion, and I'm not the only one. There are other writers. A really good book just came out from Tabitha Stanmore from a more academic historical perspective called Cunning Folk. So I highly recommend people go and get that. Really good book. Mine is more on the stories and kind of the cultural aspect. So over the past 500 years, right, we're used to the conversation about witchcraft and magic being really focused on witchcraft and witch trials, right? Over evil witch, over devil worshipping witch, right? What people don't realize now, which people 100 years ago did, was that there was a whole sphere of a tradition of spiritual practitioners who were using magic But it was like state sanctioned magic, right? Yes, the authorities didn't really look kindly on it, but it wasn't breaking any laws. And oftentimes it involved things like prayer. Oftentimes it involved things like using charms that were from the church. A very good example of this is, somebody would go to the local a farmer would go to the local Catholic church back when England was Catholic. They would take some of the host, the holy consecrated host, and they would sprinkle it on their fields as a way of imbuing that field with the regenerative powers of Christ, right? That's magic, right? Practices like that, folk charms, folk remedies, herbal remedies, things like that. And so in every single town, every single village, there was always the cunning person or the wise person. I think we're more used to listening, hearing it as the wise woman or the wise man versus cunning folk. But when you look at certain areas, they were understood to be cunning because they were cunning, they were smart, they were intelligent. They were looking at astrology. They were looking at, compacting with spirits in order to do good things for the community. Oftentimes, if something went, if something disappeared in the community, if there was a thief in the community, people would go to the wise man to do a divination to find out what. And this is, I think, this speaks to, there's a whole history around it. But one of the reasons why, I say, the Farmer's Almanac has astrology and astrological charts in it is because back in the day, farmers were using astrology to figure out when to plant crops. So it was important for them to know what the astrological, because they were really looking at the astronomical, right? And so from that, you had then these spiritual specialists. I think the best way to think of it now is, a lot of neo-pagans, they're worshiping ancient gods, they're Wiccans, they're practicing magic. They're more connected with witchcraft, and they see themselves more as connected with witchcraft. The niche that the cunning folk fit is more mediums and psychics that we have now. Because you think, right? When people have, problem with their love life, what do? They go to a tarot reader. What do? They go to a psychic fair and have a reading done. Right, we have people like any of the major psychics on any of the talk shows back in the 90s and 2000s, right? That was the same niche, but in a local setting. So when people had issues and they needed help and couldn't go to the priest for it, they went to the cunning folk, the wise people. And every single culture in Europe had this, and this includes North America. You go to Appalachia, you go to Nova Scotia, you go to parts of the South, the conjurman, right? The Yarb doctor, right? You've got the Appalachian granny magic, right? And they were everywhere, but they weren't outside of the church. They identified themselves as Christians. They were still worshiping God. They may have compacted with the devil a little bit just to get what they needed, but they weren't witches who were completely evil, right? So that's what the cunning folk were. And every single culture in Europe has a particular niche for this, It's
So
fascinating.
fascinating. It is so fascinating. I love the history of it. And that stuff is so, I mean, these people, these healers, because really that's kind of what
That's what they
they were
were, exactly.
healers. They used plant medicine. They used old folk magic. Oh gosh, so many things.
All of those
It's
things,
all based in spirituality. And I think it's interesting that you said it wasn't sanctioned by the church, but it was kind of
It was tolerated,
looked
though.
looked the other way.
Yeah, it was tolerated.
Maybe not so much in our country.
And yet, this is the thing. It was in the United States. It was because the type of niche that this was would eventually go into faith healing, right? So the ecstatic faith healers of the South, the Baptist ministers and their faith healing, and going around the country, and you look at some of the older magic from those regions, and they're all biblically based. The saying of certain psalms in order to get something, right? It's just how you're looking at it, because we're so used to seeing magic as being divorced from spirituality. Or from religion, I should say, when in reality it was very connected. When in the Protestant times, so after 1600, when England particularly split from Catholic Church, I know that happened about 50 years before that, but there were still vestiges of Catholicism. What a lot of the folk charms continued to be Catholic charms, but they were just renamed, they were revised, and so you have a continuation there. So a lot of folk practices and folk traditions that, you know, a lot of people in modern age would say, oh, that's pagan, that's ancient, it actually only goes back to Catholic times, you know? So it's again, huh, interesting how things really, it's how different centuries people viewed it, right?
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So much research I'm sure you had to do.
Oh. It was 3 months of every single day. It was great. But it was fabulous because these stories are the stories that were commonly known. And I can demonstrate that because there were particular stories that show up again and again and again in every single town and every single village all across the country, all across England and Wales, and them seeing in Scotland and Ireland, right?
So the stories, that's how it becomes folklore, because it's... Yes. Just passed, it's passed orally from person
it's
to person,
orally.
to family.
Yeah, exactly. So local gossip, it would have been, you know, started as local gossip. Some of the stories originally started out as in written sources. So these would have been in chapbooks. These, the 16th century, you know, the chapbooks that, you know, people were consuming, and a lot of material is found in that. What happens, though, with that is that over the span of 300 years, and I can track these stories through the text record. What happens is usually, you know, somebody reads a chapbook, and then later on in life they have children, they tell the child the story, and the child remembers the story, and it becomes oral, right? And then just gets passed in the community. And then eventually a folklorist comes along, hears this local story, and records it, not even realizing that it may have originated from a chapbook 150 years before or 70 years before or whatnot. And so then it's passed as local folklore, you know. So and other times it's very like etymology. It's, you know, the a very common one is, you know, somebody's lost a cow, or what, somebody's lost some money, or something's been stolen from them. They go to the local wise person, and the next day it reappears again. And what happens is that the reputation of that wise man or wise woman is so strong in that community that it's let known that this person has gone to a wise person. And so then just through reputation, oh, you know, we have to return it because the wise person is going to get us, right?
And marketing in the 1600s.
Marketing. That's exactly it. Yeah.
It's PR and marketing back then.
It's great. It's so,
they kind of created their own like web page kind of.
It's just a thing, reputation. Instagram. And like, you know, when you hear when you look at the remaining stories of some of these people, and, you know, they're all in the old folklore tale, like the old folklore collections from the 1800s, they're all in that witchcraft section, right? It's like, you know, oh, so-and-so, Marcus Lindon Barvelus from blah, blah, blah. And he, you know, he was well known across 3 counties. It's like, really, you know. But the same thing happens in every community. You know, you always have those characters in all those communities that, you know, after so long, you remember, right?
I think it's still going on. It's just that we're just so overwhelmed with it now.
Yeah.
In our electronic world, it's happened so fast. It's the same kind of thing. Humans haven't really changed that much. We haven't changed at all. It's just so fast. It's almost too fast. And it's too much, right?
It is. It's way too much. Exactly. Yeah, it's way too much. No. Modern folklore, if you look at urban legends, for example, and, well, you know, like Bigfoot, for example, or like Slenderman. Let's talk about Slenderman for a sec, right? So how did Slenderman really become a big thing? Well, it's only been around for like 15 years, right? But because the way of the internet, the broken kind of telephone of the internet, suddenly you've got all of these stories about Slenderman, and suddenly people are seeing Slenderman and, you know, all of this, right? There's a whole psychology behind it. What's happening with that in really very short period of time would have happened over 100 years or 200 years in previous centuries, just because of how the retellings are going on, right? You know.
Yeah, and that's a really unusual. I've heard a couple of podcast episodes on that. It's really fascinating. It's mm-hmm. almost manifested in the collective.
It is, yes.
And people are seeing this entity in the forest or whatever. Kids have seen it. Children have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never heard of the stories, but they are seeing it.
Yeah.
And that's really strange. And that just shows the energy, the energetic world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And wow.
Yeah. It's very strange. Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. And speaking of stories, so you did all of this research
mm-hmm.
into these localized stories. Mm-hmm. And what were some of your favorite ones?
That's a good question. So, and I think I gave that question to you to ask that, so I should have an answer.
That's okay.
I came across so many really cool ones. And, you know, apart from the ones that are very widespread, there's four that are really widespread across the entire face of it. It's the cart, it's the witch turning into a hare. So, a large hare is seen by a local farmer or a local lord, and they shoot at it. And it gets injured, and it limps away, huge, big, massive thing. And they follow it, and it leads into an old woman's house. And they open the door of the old woman's house, and she's in there, and she's got an injured leg, right? Very, very common. Very, very common. Another one is the cart. So witches have the power to stop carts. And so often the story is a cart is being driven down a lane. Suddenly the horse just stops. Will not move. You like guys whipping it, trying to get it to move, pulling it. No, and then they notice that an old woman is peering out of the window at the cart, stopping the cart just through the power of her gaze. And that's very widespread as well. There are a couple of really cool ones. I was one in the Kennet Valley, which is down in Oxford, and I think this might be the story that eventually led to what is it called? The Angela Lansbury movie, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Yeah.
That's an old one.
That is an old one.
It's a good one, though. I remember that as a kid. I'm dating myself here. I used to love that.
me too. And there's a scene in that where all of the furniture start dancing around and become enchanted, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So 70 years before, there was a story of this little old woman in this little tiny village in Oxfordshire. And she was well known in that area as a white witch. And white witch is, you know, those like kind of, they're not evil. They're kind of mercenaries when it comes to doing magic, right? They're the wise women, right? And this woman was, apparently the local lads would sometimes peek through her keyhole, and they would see her dancing around naked in her house with all of her chairs and all of her things dancing with her. And I just loved that. Like it could have been any like old hippie that we know from like nowadays, you know, I love it. You know?
Oh yeah.
Love it. Yeah. That was one of my favorites.
That's a great one. And it could have started with a couple of boys just peeping at an old lady.
It's not great, right? It's not great, but you know, what's really cool is we're so used to the witch trial stories,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, little old woman at the edge of the village, you know, she's an evil witch, so they go and kill her, right? We're so used to that dominating. We don't have these more like cozy stories, fun stories.
Yeah, they're almost mundane, a little fun, and. Mm-hmm. Kind of supportive of just the general culture. They're not really,
exactly.
I mean, out to hurt anyone.
Not out to hurt anyone.
Just kind of fun.
Exactly. It is. Yeah. And there were a couple of other stories connected with her. One was she stopped a cart because he was going to a local forest. She said, well, where are you going? I'm going to go to the local forest. Okay, let me come with you. And so he goes, takes her with him, loses track of where she is. And then suddenly she's up at the very top of a tree and she says, hold out your cap. And she flungs nuts down to him so that he has a full cap full of nuts. Yeah, it's great. It's so
fun. That's awesome. I like that.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple of other ones that were I really reconnected with my Welsh heritage in this. I think about 80 of all, like there's 220 entries in this, and it's by individual, and then all the stories connected to that individual. And I have about 80 connected with Wales, and you can really tell the culture of Wales versus the culture of England, but also the cross connections, right? And there were some really fascinating ones that really showed like Welsh understanding of magic. There was one right on the border with England and Wales, right down south, and it was to do with a boxer. So there were two villages that had a boxer for each one. This is going back to like 1700s, and they were world renowned. They were very well known, and suddenly there was a conflict between these two villages. So each boxer challenged each other. And the one boxer wasn't quite sure that he was going to defeat his opponent. And so he went to the local clergyman, local vicar, local parson, and said, I need you to do something. So the vicar went up and sat in a tree just as the other boxer was coming underneath. And he opened his magic book, because in Wales, a lot of clergy were understood to also cavort with spirits as well. Very interesting thing. And so he was, you know, reciting whatever it was, and it wasn't biblical. It wasn't biblical. And the boxer underneath him had issues with his cart, wouldn't go forward, like the wheel fell off, you know, all these things, right? And I thought that was so, like, it's so specific. And I haven't found that story anywhere else. And you know, that story is going to be told in the pub, right? You know that this is a story that's going to be shared around campfires, you know. It was great. It was so much fun.
Sounds, I can't wait to get a copy of this. Sounds like it's so much fun.
Yeah. And what's really so cool is because I'm working on the second volume now, Scotland and Wales, Scotland and Ireland, I can see how stories that, you know, I may have seen in like Cornwall are now showing up, or elements of them are showing up in, you know, Orkney or the Isle of Skye or somewhere up in Scotland. And it's like, how did those stories transmigrate? How did those stories, you know, connect, like really specific elements, you know, stories of Spanish ships being wrecked and dead princesses and like really specific stories, you know.
Definite history for sure. I mean, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
You probably know this, but you know, Aaron Mankey, the well, now he's a film writer, director. I'm not sure exactly, but
he's got a Netflix
podcast
series, isn't he?
Yes, Lore.
Lore.
And I loved that. I loved his voice for one thing, but his. They're kind of like what you're doing. They're just like little snippets of stories. But then he went and he put it on the film and each one. Oh, it's so fascinating. If everyone should check that out for sure. But I could see you doing something like that for sure. Because each one of these stories is just so, it's like a whole story in itself.
It's a whole story within itself, exactly. Yeah. And so I was very intentional with how I designed this book. And it was because of how I learned folklore originally too. So I learned folklore through some of these folklore texts. I had a particular, about four or five folklorists from the UK who I really loved and collaborated a lot. And how they designed their book was geographically. And that was, you know, place, story, and then the text, right? So I designed mine the same way. And I finally clued into it a few years ago. Psychologically, how we operate towards story, it is easier for us to understand and to remember stories if it's located to a place, if there's a face attached to it or a name attached to it, and then the rest of the details will flow. Right. And this is why how folklore in general always operates, because, you know, when you look at, say, Grimm's fairy tales, a lot of those stories were regional tales that were stripped of their locality, and then they just become general. But if you go into any landscape, there will always be stories explaining that landscape. Right. And we do this anyways. You go back to your hometown. If you live in your hometown you grew up in, you know, every single part of that place will have a memory. You know, those were bleachers where I had my first kiss. That's my elementary school. That's where so-and-so had the accident and perished, right? These are where all my ancestors are buried, right? We locate ourselves within that landscape, and all of these stories are the same way. They're ways of explaining, because a lot of these stories also connect with the devil, for example, right? You know, the devil did so-and-so, and that's why that hill has a little clip on the top. You know, that's the church that so-and-so saint, blah, 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 you know, founded and did this miracle. You know, it's a very classic way of relating to a landscape. And that is in every single culture. Every culture operates in that same way. So I designed this to kind of allow people who don't exist in or don't live in this landscape of the UK to be able to look at it and be like, oh, okay, these stories are no longer just random stories. They help to explain the landscape, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. I like that. It's location. a person and then the story follows. And that makes a lot of sense too, because when you were mentioned, you said something about like your hometown, and I remember, okay, there was the haunted cemetery. Yeah. There was the, you know, like just little places in the town, and some of them had stories, you know?
They help to locate us within that landscape. Mm-hmm. And this is the difference between folklore and fiction, is that folklore is the fourth wall doesn't exist. At any moment, we might turn a corner and come across Bigfoot or the Slenderman or the witch who lives there or the fairies, right? It's very different from if you open up a opening up a fiction book where the story and the landscape is just in the book, right? Folklore transcends that. We become part of the story, right?
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, Slenderman.
Yeah.
Which is really,
or the Loch Ness Monster.
Or the Loch Ness Monster. Oh, yes.
Exactly. You know,
that's a good one. We're still looking for that, right?
Right.
And now we have our own in the U.S. We have Champy from Lake Champlain. Yep. And there's another one, too, I think.
Is another Ogopogo? Or is that up in Canada here? I can never remember.
I don't know that one. Nope. It's probably up north. I think there's another one in, it's either New York or Vermont, like kind of on the East Coast, or but north where it's cold. But Champy, I think Champy's the big one.
Yeah, it's Lake Champlain. Yeah.
Lake Champlain, yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
That would be interesting. And so this concept of folklore, how does it meet up nowadays? Are we constantly creating new folklore as we, like Slender Man would be a great example. Yeah. I mean, do you see us continuing to develop folklore that we kind of pass down to our kids or our friends or whatever? And then they tell, you know, like the old telephone game that we used to play in grade school.
I think we do. I think that again, it's how we look at it. So I think the stories are perpetuating. And I would say, and this isn't my original idea, I have read about this, but if we look at memes, for example, so memes are a really good example of this. So in order for a meme to be understood, we have to get the reference. And through the reference, we then understand what the meme is all about, right? So if, for example, I love Lucy, you know, to express, I love Lucy and stopping all the chocolates and just stuffing the chocolates down, right? Anybody of a certain age knows what that is. But nowadays, people who didn't watch I Love Lucy when it first came out, because they weren't even in existence, they understand what that is because they understand what the story is and they can express themselves through it, right? So that is folklore.
Hmm.
Right?
That's interesting.
Yeah. Urban legends also are the modern folklore. So this is like people, you know, think, oh, urban legends are different than folklore. Folklore is traditional. Well, the urban legends we're living with now in 200 years will be folklore. Right? So like the stories of the hook, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Or the beehive. You've heard the one about the beehive?
The beehive.
Mm-hmm. So the young woman who, she is so vain that she just keeps lacquering up her beehive, lacquering up because she wants to win the competition of the best beehive in town. This goes back to the 60s.
Oh, right? Okay. Hair. Yeah. You're talking about the hair. Right.
Yeah, her beehive.
Okay.
And then she, you know, they cut it open and all spiders.
Yeah. I heard there's another one where didn't it catch on fire or something?
There's also that version too. Yeah. There's also
fascinating.
Too. Yeah. The ghost stories are one of the best ways that these stories are now perpetuated. That is like, you know, we don't have witches anymore because we have neo-pagans and we're running around, you know, the ghost stories most definitely are a really strong surviving, but also Bigfoot, also like, you know, swamp beast, also UFOs,
cryptids.
Aliens, cryptids, exactly.
Yeah. You know, dogmen. Yeah.
Exactly.
So much.
Yeah.
And I wrote this down while you were talking about the memes and current things. Mm-hmm. And there's a podcast on the Bridgewater Triangle, but it's not an interview. It's basically a story that's told. It's like fictionalized.
Mm-hmm.
So it, it takes the folklore of the Bridgewater Triangle, and the main character is a folklorist.
Oh, I see.
And he teaches at a university. And so they brought in actors to act out the story. And over a series of episodes, it's just told like a story.
Right.
And then he brings in different characters, and they're out and they're searching for the Pugwudgie. And it's really well done. And I just drawing a blank on the, I think it's just Bridgewater Triangle. Definitely worth checking out.
You might just, I don't know. No,
yeah. And of course I'm sure you know the story of the Bridgewater Triangle, and it's so fascinating. And I think that one even goes back into Native American folklore because of the Pugwudgie. I might be saying that wrong, but that one goes back into Native American folklore, which is interesting how it kind of intersects with a modern, or not so modern, but 75 year ago
totally,
account.
Absolutely.
And
totally.
That one's kind of fascinating too.
Yeah. I mean, it shows the versatility, right? It shows the versatility of this lore, right? Because I think, and there's a lot of tourism connected to that too, isn't there? I find that also comes into it too. And this has been going on for years, right? Tourism to attract people, and then suddenly there's a story. And you know, how many festivals or how many, you know, things do we have, events do we have connected to, you know, a local figure or a local legend that actually is fake, right? Where I live right now, I live in a place called Wyarton, Ontario. And Wyarton is well known in Canada because it's where Wyarton Willie, the albino groundhog, lives. And the albino groundhog is like our, you know, Puxatawny Phil, right? He's the one who makes the tells us if we're going to have more winter in February. And
I didn't know there were two.
there's multiple. Yeah, there's another one down in like Nova Scotia. When I looked into it, I wrote a little article on this. There's like something like 15 or 20 of them all across North America.
That's so fun.
Yeah, and it's, again, it's a fake story. Like it's a tradition that's only maybe 100 years old. And yet you go into town and there's statues. You can go down to his enclosure. You can see him, right? There's a big festival every year. And of course, it brings tourism dollars, right?
Oh yeah.
So, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And what a fun way to have a weekend festival and bring tourism to your small town and parades
and parades. But I think there's also something spiritual going on too, because you know, the actual basis of the tradition actually connects with German folklore. And German folklore particularly has a long history of divination through animals. When you look at where these groundhogs are, go figure, they're all in areas that were settled by Germans, right?
Oh, interesting.
Right? So it's quite historian. Cool.
The historian has dug down a rabbit hole, and this is it's so fascinating. We could speak for hours about
this. All
it's
the just, time.
It's so fascinating. Oh goodness. So tell us about, you know, where we can find the book and a little bit of information about the new book coming out and the one that's already out.
Of course. So the new book that's coming out, Wise Ones, Legends of Witches, Magicians, and Cunning Folk of England and Wales, is out for pre-order. So people can actually order it. If you're in the continental United States, you can go to crossedcrowbooks.com, and that has the link on there. You can also get it through pre-order from Amazon and Barnes & Noble, all those places too. Actually, no, I think only Barnes & Noble right now. Amazon is not on there yet, but... so it comes out in June of next year. The one that just came out, the Ancestral Whispers book, the guide to ancestral veneration practices, you can get through Llewellyn Worldwide directly, or you can order from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those local bookstores also. I like to really heavily promote because they can get most of them too. And that one is available. I think it's something like $19 or something like that. So not hugely long. But yeah, and otherwise, they can go to benstimson.com. They can find the links to all of those on there too.
And that's your main website.
That's my main website. Yeah. That's command.com. Yes.
And your website's really informative. You've got you've got courses, appearances, services, you've got a connection for that. You've got a conference coming up in South Wales, November 2nd. Is that right?
I do. So I actually have two. So if any listeners happen to be in South Wales or in Southern England at the time, there's the Welsh South Wales Occult Conference. And I will be delivering virtually to that with some amazing other speakers. The same weekend, I don't know how that happened, but the same weekend, I'll also be talking at another virtual conference out of Glasgow. And that's the Ancestral Pathways Conference. And the whole, actually the whole point of that is the unseen. So the theme of that one is the unseen. All of it's online. You can get the links for it afterwards too. And there'll be people like Morgan Daimler, who is a big folklorist in fairy lore, will be speaking at that. A couple of other really cool people, Mara Starling, I believe, who's a Welsh witch. And she speaks on Welsh witchcraft. And a really good friend of mine too. I really highly recommend Moss Mate, who is a German, a guy from Wales, who's also German, and he'll be speaking on German folklore, which is really cool too. So a lot of interesting stuff happening that weekend.
And it's virtual too. If you're not local, you can find, I think you said there was an Eventbrite on there, and you can find out about, and if anyone doesn't know what Eventbrite is, it's a way for you to get a ticket, and then you get the link and you can log in virtually to a course or conference or whatever, and then you can participate even if you're not able to be somewhere locally. It's pretty cool.
So yeah, cool stuff coming up for me. Yeah, lots of stuff happening.
I ask all my authors. I have been getting so many authors, and it's just so fascinating. and thank you so much for sharing this. I ask all of my authors, if you could give a little bit of advice to anyone in the stages or process of writing, or if you're thinking about writing, let's say you're stuck and you're not sure if you can do it, or, you know, you're kind of in that space, what kind of advice could you give to a future author?
The biggest piece of advice is to find, if you're doing it through traditional publishing, if you don't want to self-publish, is to find a publisher who represents what you want to write. And I say that because within my niche, within metaphysical niche, there's about 15 major publishers. Three of them are kind of bigger. You've got Llewellyn, you've got Wiser, and you've got Inner Traditions, right? Between those three, and those three are the major ones that when you go into any bookstore, you will see their books on the shelves. One is more about theory. Right? They're really looking for books that's going to be more academic, more theory-based, that's going to get you thinking. One is really about experience, going to be really wanting to give you a lot of experience with exercises and things to do. You can pick up a book and you can do something with it. And then the other one is kind of a mix of both, right? So depending upon what you want to write, think about the publisher that you want to approach, because they're only going to be interested in kind of if you can align with what their readership is looking for. Right? You might have a wonderful concept, wonderful idea, but depending upon your publisher, you'll have to write it in a specific way. And so looking at them, then you can think about some of the books that you love already. Well, who are some of your inspirations? What are some of the writing styles that you really like? What are some of the topics that are covered in that? Look at then how they're organized. Look at what they have in them, you know, and then look through the catalog of those publishers. And that, I think, will spur you on to make good decisions for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. So just do your own little research
as far as the
publisher and what they're, the way that they like to publish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And save yourself a little bit of trouble.
Exactly. Right. And like knowing from quite a lot of my friends and probably neutrals that we have, you know, there's a lot of podcasts out there and a lot of them cater to these questions. Right. So if you know you have a particular author that you like, go and see if they've talked about their process before. And then you can learn from that, right? Because I know I have a couple of interviews where I explicitly only talk about my process and, you know, my advice to other authors and things like that. And there's quite a few I know who've done the same. So, you know, learn from those who you respect, right?
Yeah, that's very good advice. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for
Thank
coming
you.
on and sharing, gosh, this deep dive into folklore. I want to bring you back on and we can talk about another topic.
I would love
This
it.
Is
no.
so I fascinating. Would. And I know everyone listening is just going to love this. I know I sure really enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It was kind of a last minute 1 a.m. sort of decision to put something into you, but I'm glad that we did.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. It's been really great.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Hey, thanks for listening today to another great episode. I sure enjoy hearing about these experiences, and I hope you do also. Be sure and like or follow this show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have an experience or story you'd like to share, be sure and reach out to verbalecho@gmail.com. See you in the next episode, friends. Have a great week.